Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is six-time Emmy-winning film and television composer Chris Boardman, who's going to give us some insights to the new world of film composition that I'm sure you're going to dig. But first, let's talk about Billboard and the Billboard charts. So who reads Billboard out there? I know I used to pretty religiously and stopped maybe 10 years ago because it didn't seem relevant any longer. At one point in time, the Billboard charts were the measure of how well you were doing because they were measuring sales of first records, final records, and then CDs. And then when downloads came along, they sort of ignored them for a long time. So here we had the world shifting to digital files, and Billboard didn't play along for the longest time. Well, that's not the case anymore. The last 2 or 3 years, Billboard has tried to catch up, and they've done a pretty good job. And the latest thing that they've done that's significant is they've incorporated Twitter into a number of charts that they have. So the first one is the Trending 140. And the interesting thing is anything on Twitter that refers to a song, either a hashtag or a link or a mention, gets on a Billboard chart on the Trending 140. And this is all in real time as well, so you can look at it now and it will look like one list of chart toppers, and you look at the list 10 minutes from now and it might be different. There's also a couple other Billboard Twitter charts. There's the Twitter Top Tracks and Twitter Emerging Artists. And this is important because, for the most part, the people that need this the most are emerging artists. The musicians, the artists, the bands that should be on Twitter to take advantage of this. Unfortunately, a lot of them aren't. And there's a good reason to be there now. So it's something that every artist out there should think hard about. If you're not on Twitter, there's a good reason to be there now, because your presence there is actually contributing to a chart presence on Billboard, which is really important. No matter where you go, the Billboard charts are the standard that everything else is measured by. Your success is measured by the Billboard charts, at least in record company world. So it's important that you're on some chart. Now, Billboard has some 200 charts, but it's nice to be on at least one of them because, again, it is a measure of success. Billboard also has a couple of other charts that cater to online media. They have the Social 50, which basically looks at everything on social media. It looks at all your streaming. It looks at your Facebook likes. It looks at your Twitter followers. And it includes everything to come up with a top 50 chart. There's also streaming songs, on-demand songs. There's a YouTube chart. So whoever has the most views of a song on YouTube, that gets charted as well. It's an easy way to see who's actually doing well on YouTube. They also have a downloads chart and a streaming chart. And just about everything that has to do with music online, they now chart. This is a very cool thing. Billboard, for the most part, was kind of lagging, and it was losing its importance in the music business. But they've really done a good job. So if you're not hip to any of this, go to billboard.com and take a look at their charts. You can look at them anytime. You don't have to be a member. You don't have to buy a subscription like you used to. And that's the cool thing. Now you can actually see what's going on in the charts fairly easily. So check those out. The other thing I want to talk about today is cheap microphones. Oh, we all love them. We all have the secret affair with cheap microphones, and I'm no exception at all. I want to tell you a little story. I keep my gear at a studio in Burbank called Loki Sonic, and I have all sorts of gear there, and most of my microphones, except this one here that I'm speaking on, which is a Shure SM7. And other engineers use my stuff, and that's just fine. I have no problem. I happened to go into the studio, and I met an engineer a couple weeks ago who said to me, "I use this microphone, and it was so good I couldn't believe it. I used it on acoustic guitar. I used it recording piano. I even used it on a vocal, and it sounded great." And he showed me the microphone, and I was shocked because it was the absolute cheapest microphone I own. Now, how cheap is that? I bought two identical microphones plus a stereo bar for $75. So that was basically like a $25 microphone or a $30 microphone. And it was a small diaphragm mic with no name, condenser microphone, Chinese microphone with no name on it. And my point is, my friend had no idea what this microphone was, how much I paid for it, nothing. He just went by his ears and he tried it out and he really liked it. And again, I was shocked because I knew how much I paid for it. And the reason why I bought it, I really didn't care about the microphones. I needed a stereo bar really badly that day. I couldn't find anything under like $300. And I figured I only need a stereo bar for a day. I'm not going to spend $300. So I went into the recycler, or actually in a Craigslist, I think, and there was an ad. $75, two microphones and a stereo bar, stereo pair plus a stereo bar. And like I say, I could care less about the microphones. All I wanted was a stereo bar. So I have these thrown-in microphones that actually get used a little bit, or I use them a little bit. But once again, the point is, a lot of times we have a bias that has to do with how much we spend on something. And we think automatically if we spend a lot of money, it automatically sounds great. And it's not always the case. And Chinese microphones are a really good example of that. Because in fact, usually the capsules are really good. Even on expensive microphones, the capsules are pretty much made in the same place in China, all in the same factory. There's a big difference though. Once it gets beyond the capsule, it's the electronics, and that's usually where they shave some quality off. Now, the difference between microphones, a lot of times, especially inexpensive microphones, has to do with quality control. If you get a batch of 10 microphones and you go through them, you might find one or two that sound great and the other ones sound okay, and one or two that are positively crappy. The big problem there is if you can't listen to them before you buy, it's a crapshoot. You don't know what you're going to get. And sometimes you luck out, and sometimes you don't. As you pay more and more money, the chances of getting a bad microphone or chances of getting a good one increase because the quality control is better. The other thing that happens is you're paying for microphones where the components are made in China but built in America and then QC'd here as well. So a lot of times, it's the same microphone, whether it's $50 or whether it's $500. It's just the quality control. Make sure that it sounds really good. But you very well may make out with this $50 microphone, which apparently I did here. There's another really good, inexpensive microphone that I want to talk about that I'm amazed how great it sounds. And it's an Audio-Technica 2020. It retails for about $99. And what an amazing microphone. I have to say, I tried it because I ran out of microphones on a big drum kit and I needed something on the toms, and I put it up and it was fantastic. It sounded so much better than some of the other mics I was using that there was four of them there. I put all four on the toms. They sound great, I got to say. For a $99 microphone, these are just fantastic. They all sound pretty good. The quality control for Audio-Technica is really good in general. So you don't have any of those problems with having a good one or a really good one or a really bad one. The quality control is all pretty good. Anyway, that's an inexpensive microphone that you should check out. Condenser microphone, large diaphragm condenser. Again, if you're looking at inexpensive Chinese microphones, either large or small capsule, if you can listen to them first, it's really in your favor because you're going to find that some of them are much better than you expect and some of them are not as good as you expect. So that's the real key when it comes to inexpensive microphones. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is arranger-composer Chris Boardman. He's the winner of 6 Emmys and an Academy Award nomination for The Color Purple. Chris has orchestrated more than 100 movies, including Die Hard and Lethal Weapon, and he's worked on the road with Seals and Crofts and Tom Jones. He's going to tell some good stories about that as well. He's now the program director for media writing and production at the University of Miami, and I'm really pleased to be able to talk to Chris via Skype at his home in Nashville. I'd like to welcome composer Chris Boardman, my good buddy from way back, and thank you for being on the show today, Chris.
Oh, man, my pleasure.
You used to be the musical director for Tom Jones.
Yes, back in when I was a wee lad.
And it's such a great story about the cruelty of the music business. Can you tell that again?
Oh, geez. Well, I was a young guy and precocious, and I had never failed at anything. So I thought, you know, the world was my oyster and I could accomplish anything I set my mind to. And the what happened was I got hired away from another road gig to become Tom's musical director. And 3 or 4 days after I was hired, the gentleman, Johnny Spence, who was his only other musical director at that point, died. And everybody was in a state of shock. He was 41 years old, had a heart attack, and he just, you know, died in his bed. And it was like, you know, we were just like stunned, shocked. Nobody knew what to do. And me being 23 years old, I had all the musical chops in the world. You know, the music was not really the issue. It was more, how do you deal with the personalities and the relationship issues and management skills and all that stuff, which I had no experience at. I got hired because I could do the music, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the wheels came off. It was just madness. It was complete chaos. And I felt obligated in my conscientious way to finish the tour to the end of the year. Johnny died in the summertime, and I ended up staying in a terrible situation. I should have gotten out, but I didn't know how. I didn't know how to extricate myself from a bad situation, and I ended up sticking it out. I developed a bleeding ulcer and left the road. They took me to the hospital. I bled lost a couple of pints of blood, bled internally, and it was a mess. And I think what triggered the story was they took me to the hospital in the middle of the night, about 4 o'clock in the morning. They admit me about 10 o'clock later that morning. The road manager called me up and he said, "Well, you think you're going to make the show today?" And I had blood in one arm and an IV in the other. And I said, "Gee, Lloyd, I really don't think so." And his response was, "Well, okay, see you later." He hung up the phone and they left me. So now I'm in Sierra Haute, Indiana, in this hospital room where they have no idea what's going on. It turned out it was a bleeding ulcer that had hemorrhaged. But I learned really, really quickly at that point that people will screw you into the ground if it's not in their best interest or they don't care, it's not in their focus, and you just have to deal with it.
Yes, the road can be very, very cruel. The music business can be very, very cruel in general.
You know, some people are attracted to the glamour, but you know, you're in it for a while and you realize it's just a lot of hard work. I tell my students and anybody who has any interest that, you know, the only reason you stay in the music business is because you have this deep-seated passion for making music, writing music, being in the process, whatever it is. And my line was, it's, you know, your passion is the only thing that's going to keep you company at 3 o'clock in the morning. Sitting at your desk trying to come up with an idea or finish an arrangement on time. So, yeah, those who survive end up learning how to deal with it.
Yeah, definitely. You were a composer, you still are a composer, but now you've made the transition to being an educator at University of Miami.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that in a little bit, but first let's talk about being a composer. What's different between when you started and the way it is right now?
Well, so you got about 2 years. I mean, primarily I was trained with paper and pencil. And so my history, my listening, I was into jazz. So we listened to Miles Davis and listened as much to Nelson Riddle as we did to Igor Stravinsky or Maurice Ravel or Debussy. We were looking back to the first half of the 20th century for musical inspiration and knowledge. And my career kind of progressed, not necessarily at the same rate, but along the same trajectory as the personal computer. I did my first television arrangement in 1974, and then I left college in 76, and 1977 was the introduction of the Apple I. And that pushed into the Apple IIe and MIDI and Oberheims and Prophets 5s and all those kinds of technological advancements of the late 70s. And then in 1984, MIDI became standardized and the Macintosh was introduced, which changed the game completely because now you're able to realize music in your bedroom, whereas before, experience and training, you had to hire a band and hire a studio and a copyist and conductor and musicians and the whole nine yards to be able to realize a musical idea. So about 1985, I orchestrated Silverado and I got an Academy Award nomination for The Color Purple. At the same time, the Macintosh was introduced. So, and then from that point on, the technology kept on growing exponentially. So it's funny, I have a one-space rack drive, 9-gig rack drive that I bought in the late 70s, cost $1,700. Yeah. And now you can buy 16 gigs in a flash drive for $15. So, yeah. So that's really how it's changed. To kind of tie into your previous question about education was I've shifted from being all about me to saying, well, I want to have that. My kind of mission in life is to say that what I learned from all these amazing players and performers and entertainers and in the 70s, I don't want that to end with me. Yeah. And their attitude towards life and what they thought was important is much different than somebody coming up in the 80s or 90s where there's all this money being flashed in front of your face. And so people got into it because they wanted to be rich and famous. My peers, when I was young, and my idols and my icons, the people that I looked to, they were there because they wanted to make great music. And that was kind of the end of it. So this, I've kind of gone full circle back to a point of trying to promote and sustain this attitude. Well, how do we make music better rather than say it's good enough? Hmm. You know, and know where and hopefully give a process and a direction as to how to find those avenues for yourself.
So are you saying that there are more corners cut now than when you first started in a typical?
Well, it's obvious that the technology allows you to get a lot more music with not as much training. And not to say that you, to be arrogant or condescending about those who don't have the training, but that's really the difference. I mean, to stand up in front of an orchestra and count off a tune, you have to have years of experience to be able to know what's going to work or not work, because there's so much money involved. You know, with GarageBand and maybe a couple of plugins, you can actually make some pretty big sounds, big noises. But it ends up, sometimes it ends up being coming out of the end of your fingertips, as opposed to having a musical integrity about what you're doing.
Let's go back to when MIDI first started. I'm curious about something. So you got your first MIDI rig. Did you use that as a way to check arrangements, or did you already know it was going to work? In other words, did you just program some stuff in and say, okay, so now I know this is going to work with this, and I'll have this here, or did you just know it in your head or intrinsically?
Well, that's a really interesting question because I had, by the time I had been a working arranger doing sessions for 10 years before MIDI became standardized.
Oh, yeah.
So my experience was hearing it on the page. You know, hearing it in my head, looking at the notes on the page. Now, not everybody had that experience, so I'm kind of an oddball in that regard. But the difference comes not from is it going to work or not. And this is really the significant thing. The trained orchestrator is using timbres and textures that come from the symphony orchestra or from acoustic musicians. The synth world, to try to take that acoustic knowledge and then perform it or present it in a synthetic way is not as pleasing, and it doesn't react the same. So the challenge between the two areas of expertise is to say, how do I take what I've learned in the acoustic orchestra and then make it sound good using the synth technology? There's not a direct transference.
You know, and everybody thinks there is.
No, not at all. It basically comes from the fact that if you're playing a violin sample with 24 violins, if you play two notes, you got 48 violins. If you play three notes, you have 72 violins. Yes. If you have 24 violins and you play three notes in a acoustic context, you got eight on each part.
Yeah.
And so then the texture of those different lines changes. So I end up finding that using machines, I end up writing less dense textures because the notes have more overtones and they're harder to retain any kind of clarity. If you try and stack things too deeply, it ends up sounding like an organ and it really sounds terrible. So from a compositional point of view, you end up trying to figure out how to do it with less notes rather than lots of notes and a big, thick sound.
Interesting. So how long, you were a very successful arranger before you became a film composer, and we had six Emmys, right?
Six Emmys, yeah.
Which is impressive in itself. How long did it take you to get to the point where you could hear the arrangement on the paper?
Oh, boy, that's an interesting. It didn't take too long because that's the way I was trained.
And you had a great mentor, too. Right?
I did. His name was Billy Byers, and God bless him. He was a genius, legendary in the music business. He was never one to put himself out in front, but he was a giant musician. And what he would do is his, and maybe it was just because he was stubborn, and he wanted the challenge, but let's say he was writing a five-part saxophone solo. He would write the first voicing for two altos, tenor, second tenor, and baritone in the first bar. And you know he's got eight bars to go. He'd write that first voicing. Then he would write the last voicing of the phrase.
Wow.
And then he would write eight bars of first alto from beginning to end, and then write second alto part, then write the tenor part, write the second tenor part, eight bars at a time. And so you train your brain to, it really screws with your head dramatically, because every note that you write or you're going to write in that eight bar phrase relates to every other note that you have yet to write in the future, right?
Yeah, but I could see how that would help you hear what it's going to be before it is.
Oh, absolutely.
Before you hear it. You
train yourself to hear those voicings, to hear the sound and the textures in your head.
Is that the way you teach people now?
You know, that's really not part of their lexicon. That's not really a part of their world. You know, today's youth, they work in their laptop. So interestingly, and this is a really interesting question, because how do you take that knowledge or that approach and then apply it to a different circumstance? What I've found helps them the most is going back to the saxophone example, you have a purpose in mind. You know, you have to start someplace, you have to end someplace, and you have all these different pieces of the puzzle that you have to go through to get from beginning to end. So what I stress with my students is purpose. Keep your purpose in mind from beginning to end, if nothing else, to make sure that you stay on the same intent and track that you intended.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the end, you can turn it around and look at it and say, did I hit the mark or did I miss?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, without having a purpose defined in the beginning, you'll just end up where you end up, and there's no way to measure your progress.
It seems like you might have had, I hate to use this term, but let's say it's the only one I can think of right now, sort of an unfair advantage being an arranger first and then a composer. And I would think that so many people starting today wanting to be a film composer, they don't have that. They're trying to be both at the same time, which that seems like it's automatically putting them behind the eight ball a little bit.
Well, it's definitely a daunting task, you know, because you're exercising two different muscles.
Yeah.
It's almost like a right brain, left brain kind of vibe. And the phrase that I use in my classes a lot, my students, if they hear this, they'll recognize it, is in this business, you have of creating music for hire or any kind of music, you have to, in my opinion, you need to be able to be both a participant and an observer of your work. And train yourself to be somewhat schizophrenic in the sense that if you're a composer, you're in the moment. You're accessing a different part of your brain, a different circumstance, a different experience to be in a creative moment. But once you get to the end of that, if you can stand back from it and say, gee, that was great, or gee, that sucked, or gee, that was what I was trying to do, oh, I hit the mark, or oh, I didn't quite get there, what do I have to do to change? Then you flip your brain from being in the moment to being an observer of your work and being able to learn how to critique your own work.
That's great if you can do it, but
it's a challenge. What a skill. Put it this way. Any of this is attainable if you're willing to do the work. You know, it doesn't come easy, just like becoming a virtuoso at your instrument or being a great engineer. It doesn't come easy. You got to put in the time.
Yeah.
Can't get there any other way.
What makes a good composer? I mean, if you were to listen to a score of a movie, what would make you say that was really fantastic?
You know, the greatest scores are the ones where you don't pay any attention to the music.
Yeah.
And you're not conscious of the music. Because in film, it's an interesting thing, it took me many years to realize this. As a creative person, you are asking the audience to trust you with their imagination. They have to jump in that boat with you and go on that trip and trust that you're going to deliver them where they think they instinctively know where they're going to go. So in terms of writing a great score, the music that is integrated with the story, with the intent, with the style, with the genre of the movie, all those different factors, if it's not integrated and acting as a storytelling device, then it's going to pull you out of the emotion of the movie. And that's really where a lot of people, especially songwriters, get in trouble. You know, the film changes, the tempo of the scene will change, the intent of the scene or where it's spaced in the narrative. You know, the most successful film composers are the ones who realize that they're a dramatist and not a musician.
Hmm.
That they're serving the story. And to me, it reminds me of one of my most famous quotes is when Stravinsky was asked in the early 30s, why would he want to write serial music, which is everything, it's the extension of 12-tone row. And his response was, the more limits I place on myself, the freer I become.
Interesting.
So it's like this training to be an arranger or orchestrator or what have you. If you place a box around what you're doing, and you try to accomplish a specific goal, then you are limited in terms of the palette that you have to choose from. And it forces you to think in other ways.
Yeah.
It forces you to approach the instruments, the sounds, the context differently because you have a limited number of resources. And that's a crucial skill because you end up writing a different kind of music that way, rather than something that's just, oh, this is what I do, and here it is. It's like, well, wait a minute. This is a piano piece. How can the piano create this enormous sound or play something so delicate or be linear or percussive or what have you, whatever the needs of the film or the project are. Now you have to, rather than saying, oh, gee, I play Beethoven on the piano, so everything's going to sound like Beethoven, or that's what I naturally go to. It says, well, maybe Beethoven is not the right answer here.
Yeah.
Maybe Debussy is the right answer. Well, maybe it's Jerry Lee Lewis. You know, who knows?
And you know, I can think of an example of something that you did that kind of points that out. You scored the Mel Gibson movie Payback, which is one of my favorite movies and scores as well. And
thank
the
you.
Interesting thing for me with that, the only reason why I noticed it is because there's a lot of organ in it, and I really like organ. So I think that meets your criteria for a good score. But the other thing that's interesting about it is it's a very street, has a street feel to it. And that's what you gave it. You didn't give it a sweet, big orchestra feel. You gave it a street feel because that's exactly what the movie required. And that's a perfect example right there of what you're talking about.
It's really interesting. If you're looking at, you know, like in my film class at UM, you know, we spend a lot of time discussing every piece that every student writes. And when you develop a sensitivity to this notion of story and realize, I kind of liken it like, you know, this is my age, but accompanying a saloon singer. You know, if you're playing a standard with a piano and a singer, you're going to go with wherever that singer goes. If the singer gets loud, you're going to play louder. If the singer gets intimate, you're going to play intimate. You know, that's just the way it works. If you take the approach that the dialogue in the film is the singer, you're focusing on the story, and you're not necessarily focusing on the notes. If you're coming at it, well, I got this great lick and I'm going to go paste it on this film, you get lucky, then you're in good shape. But if you don't get lucky and the director, you get hired and you do this and you're presenting your work for the gig and it doesn't, and the director says, well, I don't like it. I don't like it at this scene change. And if you don't understand what the language of the filmmaker is, you're hosed.
Yeah.
And you're just going to be lost. You know, so what do you mean? Or, for example, it's like if you're a songwriter and you say, oh, it's like a verse and a chorus. When you come back to that second verse, but the film is somewhere else, that you're going to end up thinking about the first verse instead of the progression of the story.
Yeah.
Right? Musically, anyway. So it's you have to serve the narrative, you have to serve the story, and you have to understand that your role is to enhance the subtext of that story. In other words, to help paint a picture for the characters to live in that has nothing to do with what you're actually seeing. So if you don't understand the depth of the story and why the characterizations and why this person is doing this, that, or the other thing, then it's very easy to miss the boat. Because you're thinking and you're letting your imagination go in a different way, as opposed to focusing your attention, like this Stravinsky quote, and saying, here's the box. This is as much time as I've got in this scene to be able to get accomplish what needs to be accomplished.
Everybody wants to be a film composer these days. And
oh, it's Hans Zimmer. It's the Hans Zimmer effect. That's what I've discovered.
And we're talking songwriters and we're talking, you know, musicians of all type, that's kind of a dream, especially if you're in Hollywood. But it must be really difficult to break in, and probably harder than ever, I would think, especially with all the competition. And the only thing that I could think of that would kind of work, and you tell me how this works or not, would be if you're friends with a director.
No, that's absolutely right. There's two parts to your question. Is this notion of trust is hugely important, because not only, you know, is your client, let's say the director, you know, your boss, he's also an audience member. He's also demanding trust. So to get the job, you have to have sufficient personal relationship skills to be able to connect with the person who likes your music enough to have a meeting, and instill in them, in that one meeting, in the first 5 minutes, a comfort level creatively to be able to say that if I were the director and I was looking at you to say, you're going to be my collaborator, well, do I feel comfortable enough? Do I trust him? Can I be intimate? Can I be honest? Can I be vulnerable with this person? That's number one. It's all relationships. It's all people skills. Because at the end of the day, you know, film music is a pretty small box. It's not like you're going to be asked, even though you may be trained to do a lot of different things. You know, low sustained notes means danger. You know,
yeah.
I mean, come on, it's like a high cluster that sustains with a little bit of motion. Says, oh, don't open up that door. You know? It's very well defined, and it's because we've been culturally conditioned to expect those sounds in those circumstances, right?
Yeah,
right. So it's now from the business side of things. You know, we're living in this wild time where it's really the wild, wild west at the end of the industrial age, moving into the information age. And so the Hollywood model, you know, God bless him, John Williams is amazing, but there will never be another John Williams because there's no opportunity for that type of person to find a job because they're just not making that many movies. Because the technology, disruptive technology, has changed the business model. We see it across the board in every industry. Anybody who approaches taking a product and saying, I'm going to make a product and then I'm going to ship it through my distribution channel to somebody else is suspect. The thing that really excites me and why I took the job at UM is the proliferation and the exponential growth in the use of media across the board. I mean, everyone is a creator with an iPhone, making movies, sending text messages, writing, you know, using social media. That is really, that's the future. To think that a student of mine is going to be the next John Williams or stand up in front of an orchestra and be able to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to do an orchestral score for a big action picture, maybe, but you know, odds are against it. However, with this proliferation of media exposure and usage, there is more opportunity than ever before in human history. Because there's more content being made, the question becomes, how do you stand out in that environment? What is the value proposition of the media creation that's going to drive people to be able to want to put money down and say, "Oh, I really appreciate that." We see it with Kickstarter. You know, people say, "Oh, yeah, I really like that guy. I'm going to give him $25 because I like that guy. I respect what they do." As opposed to the previous business model, which is forcing people to spend money where you want them to spend it by limiting the size of the market, saying we're only going to release X number of pictures a year. So it's kind of a convoluted thing. If you open up your brain and mind and keep an open mind, there's going to be all kinds of opportunity. But it's not going to look like what it did when I was a kid.
But a lot has changed from the expectation standpoint as well, just across the whole industry, where there's not as many big budgets available in anything,
that's right,
as let alone working on a film with the orchestral budget. And then the next problem is that you can't expect that as someone breaking into the business. If that's your goal, maybe you should keep that as a goal, but maybe you should adjust your expectations. And as they say, making a living is the new success.
Yes.
So I'm sure that's something that...
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. You know, you have to deal with what is rather than what you would like it to be, you know, or what you expect it to be, or what you dream it to be. Reality is something not always does it match. You know, does it mean that you disregard all of that training? No, absolutely not. It could, my feeling, I've had conversations with Chris Adams and Robert Tursek, who we both know, and My feeling is that if you've got 2 billion people plus a day using social media, creating content, who's going to rise above the noise? It's going, in my opinion, and this may be Pollyannish or too optimistic, but I think if you tell compelling stories and you know how to tell, build a compelling story, you will rise above the noise, because that speaks to people on a different level than just a lolcat, to paraphrase Clay Shirky. Yeah.
That's always been the case, though. The
best storytellers
are always the ones that do the best, and you can even take it down to a songwriter.
Absolutely.
Where if you're able to tell a story, you're much more compelling in what you're doing, and long lived as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm living in Nashville now, and the country audience is extraordinarily discerning about the quality of the songs they'll listen to. I mean, the quality of the songwriting here, and to your point, writing great stories, is exceptional. It's extraordinary. The bar is unbelievably high. You know, and it's a market that continues to thrive.
Well, some would say that it's really a rock market. And
well, it is.
There's a big market for rock, for, you know, 70, 80 style rock, and country is actually filling that. Of course, it's augmented with fiddle and steel and you know, whatever.
Sure.
But nonetheless, it's filling that hole in the market somewhat. But the difference being that everything is story driven and song driven, much more
That's
so
right.
than
right,
than
right.
you had Brock back then. You know, which was more riff-driven.
I agree completely. I mean, if you look at a song like Temporary Home, with the Carrie Underwood song, what an amazing story that is.
Yeah.
And in the 3 minutes, you go from 8 years old to saying goodbye to your grandfather, your father.
Yeah.
This is my temporary home. Windows and rooms I'm just passing through. I mean, holy cow, what a metaphor that pushes you into this story and engages you. This notion of trust between the creator and the audience with their imagination is huge. You can't, I mean, you're a writer. You know what that's about. Here's the thing. It's like, as you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff. You can't force people to do anything in today's world. In a controlled distribution market, you had some control where you would push out what you thought was the best. And if you had the ability to limit the size of the market, you can mitigate your risk to a certain point. And then the audience takes over and says, I like it, I don't like it, it's a hit or a miss. But that's kind of all been kind of blown apart in the last 20 years. For me, what I see is you have to invite people to come join you on this journey, as opposed to, look at me, aren't I cool? Do you like me because I'm so cool, or because I'm doing this, or I'm doing that, or the media says I'm the new media darling of the moment. You know, the Justin Bieber, the Beyonce, you know, who knows who the artist is, Justin Timberlake. Talent aside, quality of music aside, the media is pointing you in a certain direction, and your cultural conditioning about what good is good and bad is based on what you're exposed to. Not necessarily what you've been trained to believe. You know, so this notion of is now that we've kind of moved past the idea of pushing the content out and forcing people, you know, to interruption marketing, that's what Seth Godin calls it. You know, pounding people into saying, yeah, this is cool, and then they finally give up because you relentlessly pound them with advertising. It's a completely different model now, to where there has to be some sort of intrinsic reward that engages people by inviting them to join you, as opposed to forcing them, attempting to force.
They have too many choices as well.
Absolutely.
And they can turn on a dime because of those choices, and they will.
That's exactly, absolutely, the power's in the hands of the consumer. So the value proposition for the creator has to change to be able to accommodate.
So you're at the University of Miami and you're teaching the graduate program in film composition, right?
My title is program director for the media writing production program at the University of Miami, which has been around for 25 years or more. And I have undergraduate advisees, and I teach graduate film scoring and basically kind of helping bring them forward into a different concept. In fact, one of the things I'm working on this summer is shifting a class from live music direction, like being a band leader, like I started out 40 years ago, to a producer's workshop. What do you need to know? What do you need to know to be a producer? Because they all want to be producers, and that's fine. But most of them think that being a producer is pushing knobs and moving regions around. They have no concept of, well, how do you manage a session? How do you manage the mood of an artist to be able to get the performance that you're being paid to get? How do you prepare for a session in terms of music preparation, song choice,
booking time at the studio,
all of that
budget?
Of that stuff. Being a producer, you're a businessman. Not only do you have to be a creative guy, and you have to be able to manage personalities, stay on budget, and be able to be accountable for the time spent, which equals money, to the people who were paying for you to provide that service, be it an artist who's doing a DIY project or a label or some sort of business entity. So that's my one of my projects this summer is to build a website that accomplishes that purpose, so that it's online, and then we end up having discussions in a hybrid teaching approach.
Take a look at my music producer's handbook, because a lot of that is in there.
I do.
Well, thanks.
I didn't say I was wholly original.
I do a lot of thinking about that as well.
Well, you know, Steve Jobs and Henry Ford and just good people borrow, great people steal. So what can I tell you?
Yeah, well, it's been true. And you know, it's funny because I don't know if you know Ed C., who's a great engineer. He does the one that comes to mind is Martina McBride. But he's a great mixer, and he's been a mentor to a lot of other great mixers as well. But he told me his idea for, I don't remember what it is right now, but anyway, he came up with a very unique idea on something that I used in one of my books, and one of the books I credited him, and the second one I didn't. It was in the music producer's handbook, actually, although I don't remember exactly what, and I didn't credit him, and which I should have. I just overlooked it. And the next time I talked to him, he didn't say anything the whole time until right when we were saying goodbye. And he said, I saw that in your book. And where'd you come up with that? I went, oh, yeah, I got that from you. Yeah, I'm so sorry. At least I got a chance to apologize in person.
Oh,
but
it's like pull that foot out of your mouth and just pull your ass off the floor,
I mean, he was so nice about it, but he let me know that he caught it as well. But anyway, that happens to all of us, where there's so much information coming in from so many different places. We're getting it all the time, and hey, you forget where much of it comes from, that's for sure.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I've always taken an approach of modesty and humility. I was gifted with this crazy-ass analytical scientific mind from my rocket engineer father, and being an artist on top of that. So I always felt that I knew that there was somebody around the corner who was better than me. And I just walk through life with that thing. Well, it doesn't matter how cool I think I am or what the world thinks I am. It was never my intention to win awards. I just wanted to stay busy.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to stay in the process. So if you lead with your ego and it's an insecure, fear-driven place that pushes you forward, then you're going to get into a position where you use people to advance your objectives. Like in this case, in knowing you, Bobby, it was inadvertent, and there's nothing devious about not attributing the quote to the guy. But there are other people who are so ambitious that they will do whatever they think they need to do to get ahead, and invariably, I'm into this career about 45 years now, and invariably those people burn out because it's number one, in Hollywood it's a very small community.
Yeah.
And you develop a reputation of burning people, and it's from a business example, right? Either you're a cut and run guy where you just burn people and you move on to the next like a locust, or you want to have repeat business.
And
it always served me better to say, I want to, even if I may not work for somebody again, I'm going to treat them like I'm going to get in bed with them and be in that lifeboat for years. You know, otherwise I've just completely negated that opportunity.
I just remembered what Ed C. told me. It was about getting the best from a vocalist. The three P's: pitch, pocket, passion.
Oh, I got it. I'll use it. And I'll definitely attribute both of you.
Which is great, and it really makes a lot of sense. And it makes a lot of sense for any musical performance, actually. So pitch, pocket, passion. Thanks so much for being with me today, Chris. This was great.
Man,
it's always lots of fun to talk to you and get your insights. And I always learn something from you, which is even better.
Oh, well, thank you, Bobby. It's my pleasure. And you know, if I'm easily found online, and it's just to close with, I was given this amazing gift of, as a young man from the age of about 18 to 30, working with icons from a previous generation. And the reason I accepted the job at UM is I don't want that experience to end with me.
Yeah.
Right? So there's definitely a pay it forward kind of vibe going.
That's why I do these books, to capture all of that.
So, yeah. It's a privilege and an honor to be a musician. Truly.
It is.
But the reason I bring that up is I do blog. I do have a social media presence, and I'm always make myself accessible. I will acknowledge people if they want to reach out to me and have a question or this, that, or the other thing.
You have a blog dedicated to film scoring now, right?
Well, it's called In My Experience. It's called Chris Borpman Music Blog.blogspot.com. And it's just a place for me to share these different experiences, different insights that I've gained through the years, try to figure out a way to translate from 30, 40, 20 years ago, what was going on, and find out, try to pick out the best nuggets of that.
Yeah.
From an experiential point of view, as opposed to a practical experiential point of view, as opposed to nuts and bolts, this is how you do, this is how you do that. There's a lot of people who do that. But, thinking about it before I started blogging, there's not that many people who have the same breadth of experience. And it's that experiential knowledge. It's like talking about the piano player and the singer. There's an old vaudeville adage, keep your eyes on the money.
Yeah.
If you're distracted, you're not paying attention to the singer who's paying you, well, you won't last.
Yeah.
But if you always got your eyes on them and you're paying attention to what they're having to say or what they want to do, you're going to be in tune, and it's all going to work out. That's what I'm trying to share with the blog. Not specific technique.
Yeah.
I'm sure I can go there if you want, but I don't think that's as valuable or as unique.
That's a good place to end. Thanks so much, Chris.
All right, man.
If you want to find out more about Chris, go to chrisboardmanmusic.com. He also has a blog at chrisboardman.wordpress.com. And if you look up his very impressive credit lists on AllMusic or IMDb, you will be impressed. Thanks for listening and being part of my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who is the host of EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he's responsible for putting this podcast together. Thanks again, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby O's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com directly, or you can also find us on iTunes. At bobbyosinski.com, there's links to my blogs and coaching programs, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, and also the newsletter for this podcast as well, to get alerts when there's a new podcast that's posted. So this is Bobby Osinski. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.